Hello, I'm Simon Burton and this is Arts Roundup, a programme which explores all things creative in the Cambridge 105 area, meets talented people in the community and reviews the latest festivals and events and takes a look at arts news. You may find you hear reruns of earlier editions from time to time as we juggle material from a bank of presenters into our schedule, but it's easy to find the latest podcasts on our website and the newest catches both broadcast and uploaded every second Saturday at 11 a.m. Whatever you're looking for to test your developing talents or to just go out to and enjoy, we hope you'll find it here and to discover the new and fantastic things going on in the city. In this week's edition, Cambridge 105's Toby Miller reports on the African Film Festival after sampling some of the exotic and inspiring celluloid with director Mike Boyd. A spectacular fire performance coach and City Council fireworks display designer tell us what puts the fire into their creative bellies as fire artists and the backdrop to state-of-the-art crowd-pleasing. An extraordinary and colourful Russian choir performs in Cambridge tonight only. A new arts project from Little Port near Ely in the Fens gets a much-needed cash injection from the New Heritage Lottery Fund to beef up local culture and display its art and history to the region. And the Winter Wordfest lines up a set of impressive speakers. But first, let's look at a few highlights of what's on in Cambridge. Mike Bartlett's new play, Earthquakes in London, opens at the Arts Theatre on Tuesday, November the 8th. It looks at modern excess, the population explosion and family crisis, and asks us, will it lead to the end of the planet? Subversive stand-up comedian Omid Djalili presents Tour of Duty at the Corn Exchange. There's a 70s blast from the past as legendary punk band The Damned returns to the Corn Exchange alongside the redoubtable Captain Sensible next Friday. The Art and Craft Design Show runs this weekend at Newmarket Racecourse. If you have the hands for it, the Corn Exchange is making a public invitation to pianists to try out a magnificent Steinway piano recently repaired because they say it really needs to be played. Access Art celebrates its 12th birthday with a story writing competition for all ages called Share a Story and Inspire an Artist, submissions to be in by the 15th of November. And an arts collaboration project by organisation Creative Front brings together digital artists across the east of England with other art talent in an event called Arts and Culture Kickoff on Tuesday the 8th. The Cambridge African Film Festival starts at the Arts Picture House tomorrow, a fledgling component of the Cambridge Film Festival for the past 10 years, and is generating a growing following in its own right in the contemporary African cinema. The films range from documenting how people's heart-wrenching life experiences shape them into the people they are. They also deal with family separations and African society issues, and even look at the lighter side of African comedy. Cambridge 105's Bums on Seats presenter Toby Miller's been with director Mike Boyd to talk about the history of the project and to preview four feature films over the next few days.
It was started by a group of students here at the University of Cambridge who realised that there wasn't really a place to air African films. And they were very aware that lots of African films were being made, but not shown in the Western world. The students wanted to change the Western view of Africa by showing films made by Africans and representing their own lives. So it was very much a space to show African films, to have African filmmakers come along to talk about their films, to really represent Africa in a different light, to show the real Africa, really. That was its aim.
Obviously, we've just had the Cambridge Film Festival, which is dozens upon dozens upon dozens of films in every single genre known to man. This is four feature films and a bundle of shorts. How do you begin sourcing these films?
It's really actually thanks to one of the founding members, Lindiwe Dovey, who now works for Film Africa, which is the film festival run by the Royal African Society down in London. And I'm in touch with her constantly. In fact, she programmed this festival in conjunction with Film Africa. We're hoping to grow again, but it's very much the connection with Film Africa that's given us the chance to have these films here. And it's been in conjunction with them. We've contributed to the filmmakers coming over, and we're going to organise print transport and so on between London. But we are an arm of Film Africa.
Tell me about the four feature films that are screening, what they're about.
Absolutely. In fact, it's quite interesting about the films. They gradually work their way south through Africa. They start in the north, so we've got Morocco, we've got Fragments on the first night, which is a documentary by Hakim Belabis, who basically he filmed a documentary over 10 years. It's very much a personal portrait of his family and of his life, but it also obviously therefore has the offshoot that it's also a history of almost Moroccan society in today's world. Next we have Notre Étranger, or A Place in Between, which is from Burkina Faso. It's a Francophone film about a young woman who grew up in France but had a mother from Burkina Faso, and she goes back basically to try and find her mother. She had a French father and obviously a mother from Africa, so she's always lived in between, I guess, in different worlds. Next we have Kundi and the National Thursday, which is our next documentary. It's actually a really interesting story about a village, and it's in an area of Cameroon where this village is situated. It's a very heavy timber area traditionally. It's quite a rich timber industry going on. But this village have actually decided that, and they've foreseen that it's not a very sustainable resource. It's not something that in today's world is going to keep on going. So what they do is they decide to start a cocoa plantation, and it's the reverse of the normal story of Africa, which is what this festival is about in some ways, is that people see Africa as poverty and aid, aid from the Western world, and about receiving money and those sides of things. This is actually a documentary about a village that is actually doing something for itself and on its own, and showing that, you know, people, if they get together, a very community spirit to start something that keeps them going on their own basis. Next we have Dreams of Elibidi, which is a Kenyan film. This is quite an interesting film because it's very much an educational film it's basically about HIV/AIDS in modern day Kenya, about a man who decides that he's going to move to Nairobi to start a better life for his wife and his family, and ends up in one of the slums in Nairobi. And it's not so much about him, but his four daughters that are then growing up. And it's almost a coming of age tale in Nairobi. I'm quite excited about that film, actually. It was described in Kenya as a film made by Kenyans for Kenyans, which again is also the point of this festival. I think we want films made by Africans to tell us their stories.
The films that you're showing, the four films that you're screening, as far as I've been able to tell, are the products, with the exception of the final film, are the products of African middle class, slightly 30 to 40s age group. And I wondered if there was another voice that was coming up underneath that.
I think certainly there's almost a drive that I've been aware of in the last few years for this rural class to rise up and tell their own stories. I think a lot of it, I don't know if a lot of it's happening, to be honest, in terms of the money to finance these things, and also the technology, the equipment, and so on. I know I mentioned Nollywood again, which is a huge phenomenon, and that is probably quite city-based, but it's very much, what's interesting about Nollywood is the exhibition side of it. It's not a cinema film movement. It's very much... that's become huge through the market stalls of Nigeria, of selling the DVD, you know, making 100 copies at home and sticking it on a market stall and selling it, and that's been a huge phenomenon, and that's made lots of money. So I think that's given people a lot of hope, certainly people without much money to make their own stories. But certainly movements from the Western world as well, and I know I've heard of CamFed, which is actually a Cambridge-based organization, have put quite a lot of time and effort into a film made in Zambia actually a couple of years ago, which was a story not only about rural classes but also about women filmmakers and getting them to tell their stories and having filmmaking workshops. Just a couple of weeks ago I was talking to an organization, another Cambridge-based organization called Concordis International, and they're going to be working with South Sudanese people over the coming year with filmmaking workshops. Again, it's and we're hoping to show some of those films next year, actually, at the Cambridge African Film Festival. I think it's growing. I think people are very much aware of it, and in Africa, well, I hope they are, and my hope is that we see a lot more of it, because Africa is actually full of stories. That's one thing that must be said about Africa, with the folklore and a very oral tradition of storytelling, which hopefully will come out in the films again.
Toby's show, Bums on Seats, is back on air at 11 a.m. on the 12th of November. The season for celebrating our popular past conspiracies is upon us again, as the skies prepare to be lit up with some pyrotechnic art. The people who designed and wrote this year's plot for the Cambridge display on Midsummer Common and prepared the spectacular stage fire performance have been telling us about how it's done, but there's more going on out there. It seems the embers of the events of the gunpowder plot of 1604 by Catholics against James I and Parliament by Guy Fawkes and Robert Catesby and others never really go out as part of our history. It all went disastrously wrong for the plotters when the Earl of Salisbury noticed a suspicious pile of wood in the basement of the Houses of Parliament and raised the alarm. Later, one of the conspirators was drying wet explosives by a fire and was blinded by the ensuing explosion. Others, including Catesby, were cornered in a sword fight and perished there and then. And then the remaining plotters were caught, hung, drawn and quartered, save just one. Well, the Catholics did spook the establishment, and it led to a swashbuckling but ill-fated adventure. This year, it seems, is no different. You may have noticed across the internet and at public occasions the growing army of cloaked people wearing white Guy Fawkes masks cribbed from the film V for Vendetta. Anarchist hackers from the ginger group Autonomous are protesting, using Guy Fawkes as a symbol against banks, politicians and financial institutions, stating publicly that governments should be afraid of the people. Firework expert and competition judge Will Scott, who designed the display, came into 105 to tell us about what goes into it, and Guy Smith from Wildfire Productions gets to grips with fire eating and other things kids really shouldn't try. They're both as computer savvy as the living tradition of anti-establishment plotting that's going on. And the whole tinderbox equation is set to be lit just once more, now as a powerful and expressive art form. Will, first of all, tell me a bit about yourself, because I've been reading your website and you seem to be a man of many parts, in so much as that you worked on all kinds of interesting projects.
Well, a man that's falling apart at my age, I've been a fine artist. I've worked narrowboats, I've worked in films, television. I started in the theatre. And then I got involved with fireworks. Ironically enough, here in Cambridge was the first commercial show I ever did with a guy called Tim Hunkin.
How do you qualify to be a fireworks expert?
Well, you can now. There are courses now that you go to. If you join a company as a labourer, then they can put you through various training courses run by the British Pyrotechnics Association, various levels, you know, from basic understanding to site management. But in my time, there wasn't anything like that.
What's it like actually experimenting with fireworks? Presumably you have lots of explosive fun in labs and...
I was never much of a manufacturer. Yeah. I did run the Mater at Peterborough for a long while, which involved the factory. But I've never really been involved in manufacturing. I've been more on the display side, the concept of using fireworks, as opposed to the experimental making of fireworks. Although, having said that, in my last company, I spent a lot of time in China in factories saying how we wanted shells to look, actually drawing them for them to say, I want this effect, I want this effect, and seeing tests saying, can you take that out and put that in? So, yes, in designing items, yes.
Now, you've worked as a firework labourer. What exactly does that involve?
That's the short end of the stick, sunshine. That's the...
The lightingman?
No.
No.
That's unloading trucks.
Unloading trucks and things like that. Oh, I see.
Getting the trucks out of the mud. I hated November the 5th. I avoided it once I became a director of companies.
I mean, obviously, historically, lighting fireworks has always been an incredibly hazardous business, hasn't it?
I don't know. I don't think it's incredibly hazardous. I think if you use your common sense and you take certain precautions, it's no more hazardous than crossing the road on a, you know, try to get across Hyde Park Corner. And I think you've got the same kind of risks management, you know. There's very few firework displays now, maybe small ones. And don't misunderstand, I have no understanding really of domestic fireworks, the kind of fireworks that people have in their homes. I don't know much about those. I only know about the display work, and everything's virtually electric now, so the crews aren't near it.
Now, how did you land a prestigious job like doing the Cambridge firework display? Because it's something that takes quite a lot of input, doesn't it, to get something
It takes a lot of input, but I used to do it 2 or 3 years ago under the name of Pyrovision. And then I think Kim Bolton came back and did it, and I think the way Kim Bolton's going with the eye and everything else and all their other work, they're just so busy. So having known the site and known the council, I just happened to see Eddie, and he was saying, "Oh, you know, I wonder who we're going to get this year." And I said, "Well, give me a, you know, I can get a company together and get a design together." And he said, "Oh, I'll think about you."
Now, that sounds like a really interesting project, designing a fireworks display. Presumably, as time goes on, they get more and more sophisticated, and crowd-pleasing is an art in itself. What, in fact, goes into something like that?
Well, it's a little difficult for me this time, because when I was Pyrovision, obviously, I knew my palette. I knew every type of material. I'd been to China, ordered it, designed it, and knew everything about it. I've done a few jobs with Jubilee Fireworks, who are a very prestigious firm. I mean, they fire all in competitions all over the world, and I liked them because when I was Pyrovision, we won at Monaco, and one of the only other companies to win at Monaco was Jubilee Fireworks. I have a great respect for their chief designer, but given the fact that I knew the site, they said, "Well, you get on with it, you know, it's your show." So you're designing from a palette of some of which you don't have much knowledge. So there's a lot of telephone calls about, yes, it says this, but is it really doing this? And I want this in this particular type of show. What do you recommend?
Now, it's obviously, it's a form of art, and you need to be quite creative in order to make that work, don't you?
I'm a great believer that firework design is an art form, and it's showing more and more now. I'm a judge in various firework competitions in Southport and Plymouth, and the Southport one is a paramusical competition, which does have to pull all of the artistic concepts out of a designer. You know, Cambridge is a November the 5th show. Let's face it, it's a robustious, crowd-entertaining show, probably with not as much delicacy as you would have if you were designing to music. But given the nature of the firing systems now and the computer control over items, it can be very, very sophisticated. And I'm a genuine believer, as I said, in it being an art form.
And do you actually prefer to do things to water music and things like that? Does that make your job easier to have the music?
Yes, I feel that way. Because, I mean, by the time I finished full-time fireworks, virtually 98% of the work was fired to music.
Now, Cambridge has more than its fair share of fireworks displays with the Maybles parties and wealthy houses and Midsummer Common. So is there a sort of, I mean, are you going to be upstaging a few people with this particular display coming up this year?
Well, I want to entertain people, and I want to entertain them in the kind of November the 5th genre, which means, as I said, it's going to be very rumbustuous. You know, there's a lot more colours in the display than I would use normally, because I'm, you know, each designer has his own favourites, and mine is silver and gold, because they're the purest, in my opinion. But with a lot of gold, you get a long fallout, and given the nature of Midsummer Common, if the wind's in the wrong direction, you have got the crowds on three sides, which is a problem.
How important is money to what you can do? Because obviously the funding and sponsorship of the fireworks display goes up and down, depending on how rich people are feeling in terms of what they can put in.
Money's always always an essential element, obviously. The more money, the bigger and better the show. Having said that, some sites have a limitation. You know, no matter how much money you've got, they may not be the capacity to spend that money on a site. Whereas some sites, you could spend £300,000-£400,000 and you still wouldn't be able to pull it off completely.
Have you got any good crowd pleasers up your sleeve for this year?
I have, and they're staying up my sleeve. They're staying a secret. I want I want it to be... It'll be a bit more noisy than usual. You know, my feeling is that it's usually November the 5th, a cold night. People are waiting. You know, they want to kick up the bum, really. Hmm. And that's, you know, that's the kind of show that I hope we're going to produce.
Obviously, the gunpowder plot of 1605 is the backdrop to Fireworks Night every time round.
That's a mistake, actually. Gunpowder plot was July the 3rd. Mm-hmm. I've been convinced of that since I ever got involved in fireworks, and the whole November thing is a complete mistake.
Mm-hmm. Now, this year, obviously, you've got... I mean, during the gunpowder plot, which was obviously a rebellion against James the First by Guy Fawkes and Catesby and Henry Howard and various other people who decided that it was a sort of Catholic rebellion, who decided to blow up the Houses of Parliament, which everybody knows about. Yes. And they were all caught for treason and treachery, yes. and half of them were killed in a sword fight, and the rest of them ended up hung, drawn and quartered, and I think there was only ever one survivor. Now, this tradition of fireworks and rebellion still seems to live on today. I don't know whether you've seen on the internet, there's this group called Anonymous, who are anarchistic hackers who are popping up in public places with Guy Fawkes masks on everywhere. Do you think there's still a little bit of that British, you know, thing to... I mean, they've stated that the government should be afraid of the people, and they're trying to spook people with the fireworks night thing.
Anarchy is nothing new, is it? I mean, that's been going on a long time. Yeah. You know, whether it's Catholic versus Protestant, personally, I stay out of that argument. Having said that, I've been letting off fireworks for 40 years, and I've got an MVO for the Queen, so I'm quite, you know, part of the establishment. So I think that if you want to go to somewhere like Lewis, where that whole tradition is kept alive, now that's something else. You know, they have a special dispensation from Europe because it's a cultural thing.
Obviously, the sealed knot came from Ely, quite near Cambridge, which was like another insurrection. And did you know that there's actually still a surviving member of the Catesby family living in Cambridge? It's amazing that all the way through history, they're still in living memory, people who go back all the way back to the plot.
I was aware, you know, because of the Puritan and every, you know, the all of that association, Cromwell and everything with East Anglia, that there's a big, you know, a big anti-establishment group, you know, where a lot of the revolutions in this country have come from around here. But that might have something to do with living in the Fens rather than being political.
But it's amazing that these fires never go out in Britain, do they? They sort of go down, but they're still the embers there of what's happened in the past.
It's because it's become a tradition. You know, it's because it's become part of the fabric of society. I mean, people refer to November the 5th as an occasion. If they're talking around, referring to a part of the year or something, they talk about, well, around November the 5th, you know. So it is a fixture in people's mind about bonfires and...
Also, there are firework performers, fire performers, are performing at your...
So I understand.
These are people who are going to do acrobatics, juggling and stunts with fire. Yeah. I mean, do things like that. I mean, obviously, they're very difficult things to learn how to do safely, and obviously there are safety issues, but it is really about bringing everything alive with pyrotechnics, isn't it?
Well, it is. Again, you know, that's a tradition. That's how I started. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember climbing a 20-foot-high scaffold tower in an airport fireman suit in the engineering department of Cambridge to celebrate one of their events, with 10 pounds of black powder on the top of the scaffolding and firing the whole lot, so you looked like you just arrived from outer space. And there's another group that who their original pyrotechnist is now a very famous man from Group F, who used to do the Eye and the Olympics and things like that. So they're fire groups. They always have been.
Now you've done, I mean, not only have you done Cambridge Fireworks Display, but you're known as a fireworks expert, and you've also worked with people like Pink Floyd.
You've
arranged weddings for King Hussein of Jordan. You've done special effects on the film The Battle of Britain.
Let's qualify my role in Battle of Britain. I dug holes for them to put the gelignite and the cement in, the bags of cement. You know, I was a very, very lowly apprentice.
But you seem to have got into so many interesting things.
I've been lucky. I think it's much harder now because, you know, there are so many more things going on. And there are so many more people who actually are considering a career in the kind of things I've done. Mm. Whereas I was just happened to be lucky. You know, it's one of those situations. You happen to be in the right place at the right time. You know, and how I got involved with Pink Floyd wasn't because I was in the music business or anything. It was because they wanted some sheep and pig shells made, and nobody in the country would make them apart from Tim Hunkin and myself.
Okay, so you've fully stacked the fireworks display. It's going off this evening. Everybody's going to be there to see it. I think it's going to be fantastic.
Well, let's hope so. Fingers crossed. I hate interviews before. Talk to me afterwards, you know.
Thank you very much, Will Scott.
And Guy Smith, the performance director of Wildfire Productions, is directing spectacular entertainment with fire dancers, jugglers and flame eaters, which took months to perfect.
At Wildfire Productions, we take the headache out of organising performances for events. We do everything from belly dance to burlesque to fire performance, pretty much anything you can think of. But the core essence of the business is our fire performance.
Fire performance, yeah. I mean, how big a deal is it for a company like yours, for Wildfire, to actually stage something as big as the Cambridge City Council fireworks display, which is a very big event?
Well, it's definitely a big thing for us, and we're very pleased that we're able to do it. At Wildfire, we've done performances for every size from sort of 8 to 8,000 pretty much, but we don't obviously have so many of the 8,000 numbers of gigs, so it's a big opportunity for us and we're pleased to be there.
Can you tell me a little bit about the scope of what you're actually going to be doing on the night?
On the night, we'll have about 18 performers, and we'll have some drummers there as well.
Yeah.
We'll also have a number of technical safety officers there to sort of make sure that everything's going okay according to plan, nobody's catching fire, anything like that. And what we're going to do is a series of choreographed performances for the crowd.
And what will those involve? Is this acrobatics or with fireworks? Or
This isn't with fireworks. Okay. What we're doing is we're doing a fire performance with different props.
Yeah.
Fire poi, fire staff, fire fans. I don't think we've got the fire whip out this time, but we might do next year. What we'll be doing is showcasing a number of different skills. Juggling related, you can expect to see sort of lots of sort of thing that you might have seen in shows at festivals, that kind of thing.
Now, how difficult is it to get a good knowledge of how pyrotechnics work to actually perform with them? Because it's quite a thing, isn't it, to flame throw and things
well,
like that.
It certainly is. It certainly is. And it's not something that you can undertake lightly. When I first came into fire performance, before I even considered setting fire to poi, I spent 2 months practicing every day with them for at least 1 hour just to make sure I was 100% used to the feel of them. And even then, when I did set fire to them, it was pretty terrifying. And all the time, we're trying to do more courses in safety, making sure we've got first aid trained people on hand.
I'm reliably informed that there's even a surviving Catesby descendant still living in the city who's probably enjoying this evening's show the most. The fireworks ends quite early in the evening, so if you've an appetite for making a really special evening of it, you might find a visiting group of Russian singer-performers on at the Emmanuel United Reformed Church in Trumpington Street, an uplifting treat. The Sakyope Ensemble from Georgia is a choir with a difference and features exhilarating Russian dancing, brightly flashed traditional costumes with swords and delightful onstage antics. The 12 male choristers from Tbilisi are here for the first time tonight only, and their music obeys no Western scales but is harmonious, a touch soulful and beautifully rhythmic. You can preview the show on podcasts at sakyope.ge or on YouTube. Organiser Miranda Gray, an artist and singer, and her husband geologist Ashley Armour Brown both introduced the choir and a tradition that survived communism dating back thousands of years. Miranda, now this is music with very special origins and a story behind it. Can you tell me a little bit about where this music came from? And
a lot of the music is very, very ancient and it's been orally passed down. It hasn't been written as music, but people have sung this music because it's part of their lives, and they at every occasion in their lives. They have a song.
It's very well tied to folklore as well, isn't it? The traditions that go back into history a long time.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And it is a way that the Georgians, who are often attacked by other people who want to come into their beautiful country, they keep their solidarity and they feel united in song.
This particular choir, they're probably a young choir. Some of them are musicians, but most of them have ordinary jobs. But they're so keen on this. They all sing probably two or three times a week.
Their leader, Malkas Erkvanice, has been here to Cambridge before, and he's led workshops. And he has he once came in his choir, which was the Anshiskati choir, about 10 years ago.
How different is their culture to ours in Cambridge? I mean,
they're much better at expressing their emotions, and this comes out in the music as well. And I think that's the main difference. But the extraordinary similarities with how they do things. I always take the example of their Christmas songs, which they go around the streets like our caroling or whistling, and will sing a song to a house and expect people to come out and give them some food or drink or some vodka or cha-cha. English people listening to it often find it a bit sort of sad, but I hope there'll be really joyous things. And when they're singing wedding songs, I mean, they're just over the top. There's nothing soulful about them at all. It's just...
There is something slightly humorous about a piece which is about talking to his ox as he's going along the path. It's a song about an animal. Or is it more about endurance and hard work?
Yes, it's having a good relationship with your animals is part of their way of life. That they work hard and they know that the animal helps them, but they are, you know, they have respect for the animal and they feel it's worth singing about him.
A couple of songs. There's one particularly about a very famous song called Asho Shela, which is about, these two oxen, what a hard life you've got, oh dear. But really, the singer is singing about his hard life as well. There's another song, singing to his Chonguri, where he's bemoaning the hardness of his life. His Chonguri is an instrument, it's playing. And this again is sort of slightly complaining or being philosophical about how hard life is.
Ваше карте доставлюта сам шум лога хари ворира рира ворира та ворира ванило ди лаворанина ворира
If you frequent the Fens, you'll soon find an arts watering hole developing in Littleport, just north of Ely. The new Heritage Lottery Fund has awarded £49,000 in new funding to the Word Garden Project to showcase local art history and culture. Local people, schools, museums and artists are going to throw the town's profile and past into sharp relief with films, photographs, collections and drama. Zoe Davidson of ADEC, Arts Development of East Cambridgeshire, Adam Giles, a filmmaker, and Jean Rees, a playwright, introduced the Family Adams project.
The Word Garden approached ADEC. We've been working in partnership and we put in a heritage lottery bid for the Family Adams project, and we were successful in being awarded £49,000 for a project in Littleport.
And what's this going to mean? Can you tell me a little bit about the scope of the Word Garden project?
Yes, well, there's a number of so-called creative practitioners working together. There's going to be a scale model of the interior of Adam's shop. The shop was built in 1893 and was looked after by the same family, the family Adams, hence the project name, the Family Adams Project. So there's going to be a scale model, there's going to be a film, a documentary film of the inside of the shop with various actors doing things in the shop. There's going to be an exhibition of photography inside, again inside the shop. There's the materials, the furniture in the shop is still the original furniture. On one wall there's 177 drawers. And there's lots of things apart from that happening.
Now this is really going to bring Littleport's arts community alive and put the town into sharp relief. It's a particular period in its history that you're focusing on, isn't that right?
Yes, it's 1880, yeah. 1930. We've approached that period because that was really the height of Littleport's social and educational, to some extent, success. The skating was happening then, and the schools were beginning to do more training, you know, more time was spent in school. But the story is really has and is centred around the last of the Adams family, who is Doris Elizabeth Adams. And she was a young woman who was very bright, taught Sunday school, and knew all the children in Littleport. So we've sort of gone 1880 to bring in the skating element, which is very significant in the history of Littleport, through to 1930 to cover the growing up period, really, of the young people at that time.
Now, skating on the Fens is quite a well-known pastime. What's the skating like at Littleport? Presumably kids get involved in that as well, and it's a powerful experience.
Well, yeah, I've got a bit of a skating background. I'm a bit of a Fens skating enthusiast, and it's really important, this particular shop, J.H. Adams & Sons shop in Littleport, because it used to have the franchise for selling Fens skates, speed skates. So it was a bit of a mecca. It was definitely a centre for skating. People used to go there to go and buy their skates. So there's lots of historical stories and accounts of Fens skating in Littleport. So we're hoping to pick up on a bit of that. But we have to wait for the ice. So we rely on the weather. So fingers crossed we might get some skating this winter and we'll see people out on the Fens nearby skating. But it is weather reliant.
All right, now this project is going to bring in a number of elements, isn't it? It's going to be photography, film, art and history projects. Now, you're doing some filming. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, well, myself and my business partner, we're actually working on the filming side of it. We're also producing a website. So we've got a familyadamsproject.org.uk website that's out there. So that's sort of promoting what we're doing and telling people about each individual part of the project that Jean's just spoken about. But the filming side is really to use video to archive the shop and also archive the stories, speak to the people that currently work there, there, and to some of those people that bought the skates from that shop as well. So we're really trying to connect with the local community by using video.
Now we're going to be, and as people are dropping in from the region to go and visit Littleport, which will become a little bit of an arts oasis during this project, what will the public be able to find immediately available?
Well, we're going to have a launch, which we want to tell you about. It's Saturday, the 26th of October, and it's at 26th of November. Gosh. Okay. So, yes, we're having a launch for the project where we'd like people to come to bring their memories, to bring artifacts. We want young people and older people to look for things that they might have had of the period, the pre-war, First World War, skating, letters, tickets, old bus tickets, anything that relates to how Littleport, and in fact probably the surrounding areas, was at the time. And that's going to take place on Saturday, the 26th of November, at Young People Littleport, which is YPL, and that's on Granby Street. And it will be from 10 to 12 o'clock.
Now Zoe, this project is probably very important for families and schools. So how important has it been for you to be able to get this funding secured so that the project can go ahead? Because it's very difficult in rural areas, isn't it, to actually get the money to do these things?
Yeah, if we hadn't have received the funding from Heritage Lottery Fund, we wouldn't have been able to do this project. I think it's really important that we've been given this funding because we can really get the whole of the community of Littleport involved with going into the schools, going to the museums, and going and interviewing older members of the residents of Littleport. So I think it's really important that we've been given this.
Now it's £49,000, but that can go a very long way, but it's spread between a number of projects, aren't there? What's the scope of the different projects that are involved?
We have a play that's being written, we have a film, we have a website, we have a model box, we have the workshops going in with the schools, and we also have a professional photographer photographing the Adams shop. So it really is going an awful long way. It's stretched. We would like more, but...
and what goes on in the museums? It must be a bit of a triumph to actually be able to activate all of these things.
We're actually working in partnership with museums, and we're using them to help us with the project, getting memory boxes from them to take into the schools so the young people can see artifacts that were around at that time.
As a playwright, I mean, that's a very difficult thing to do. Will you be able to be teaching people a little bit about that, or creative writing?
Yes, you've really quite hit the spot there, because it is, the play is an attempt to bring all of the elements of the project together. So, and it's also based upon memory and ideas and anecdotes. So we're doing a combination of improvisational workshops, and where the script develops through the work that the young people are doing. For instance, there's King's School involved, there's Littleport Community Primary School involved, and possibly Millfield will be involved. But we're working with youngsters from the age of about 10 to 17, and they will be learning about the history at the same time as developing script material from improvised workshops. Then they will rehearse the work they've written and created with guidance. We're having guidance from lots of different people. We've had a lot of support, free of charge support from lots of different people. So as a playwright, yes, it's quite a challenge, but it's also coming from the people.
And does it have a name or a plot yet, or is it something that's gradually being pulled together, basically?
No, it actually has a name, the play. It's called The Gypsy Play at Café Marguerite. Café Marguerite was actually a café in Granby Street in Littleport, which was mentioned in the Barber's Archive almanacs for right up to the 1950s. People from Littleport would go for wedding celebrations, funeral celebrations, all kinds of celebrations. And so we're having the set as Café Marguerite. So we're recreating Café Marguerite in the village hall.
Fantastic.
And the gypsies, actually, Doris Elizabeth taught her Sunday school children to do a gypsy dance. So we're going to do gypsy dance.
I think it's vital for young people and children to learn about the history of the area that they live in, and such a vibrant history as well. So being able to have this funding and go into schools with professional artists and practitioners is invaluable. I mean, it's a great opportunity for teachers, schools and the creative practitioners. We're all kind of working together and learning together as well. So it's really interesting.
Now Adam, as a filmmaker, can you teach kids how to storyboard their ideas? I mean, is that something that you do as part of this project?
Well, we have got on the filming part of the project, we have got some students working with us, so they'll be getting involved with the process, coming along to the filming and also the editing as well. It is very much a documentary film, so it's a little bit sort of suck it and see on the day, depending on how things go with the people that we're interviewing. But it's, you know, very much understanding that process. But post that, of course, obviously all of these wonderful assets, Jean's play, there's a wonderful book that's being created, they're all going to be put up on this website. So beyond the kind of project period, which is several months, this is going to live on.
A programme of literary treats commences in Cambridge on November the 27th. The Winter Word Fest returns to the ADC Theatre and has once again attracted many excellent authors. Speakers will include Alistair Darling, the former Chancellor of the Exchequer. Ian Hislop, as Private Eye, celebrates 50 years of satire, gives a talk. And Dickens author Carol Tomalin talks on her new work. Peter Popham expounds his portrait of the Burmese dissident leader Aung San Suu Kyi, and writer Diane Athill will discuss her life and work. Tickets are available from October the 28th at the ADC Theatre. And that's all we have time for on this edition of Arts Roundup, and I hope you enjoyed the hour.